Okay, great. So welcome to this Buying in Auction Masterclass. And basically it is how you can build a solid business in property with six simple steps and is following the simple framework. But indeed, buying in auction is the context in which we're learning about today. So we're, you know, buying property the regular way is sort of what we're used to, and most of us would have probably had experience buying that way. But then this is sort of a specialized way of going into a discount market to buy in auction, and we're going to cover all of the fundamentals of that process. I just want to hide the video panel and stop the video. Okay, so we're following the simple module, but then we're also understanding the fundamentals of buying through the auction. And this is usually buying discounted properties. So the key principles, so why auction? Then different sources and the different ways you could potentially find and purchase property. So why would you normally come down through the auction route, which sometimes can have its own challenges, which we'll talk about, and we'll talk about how you can overcome those challenges. But then why auction? Why you have to think about it for yourself. Is it because you're trying to get a good bargain? Is it because it's a straightforward process? You know, what is the reason why you would buy an auction? And then how much is your budget? Because obviously if you're going to auction, you have to know what your budget is to buy a property. You know, what is your strategy? What strategy are you looking to employ with your purchase? So are you just going to buy it to hold? Are you going to buy it to sell? Are you going to, most of the times when you're buying an auction, you're going to need to refurb. Although that being said, there have been occasions when I haven't had to refurb the property where I just picked up the keys and the property was in stellar condition. But most times, I would say 95% of the time, the properties will need work. And then how are you funding this? We're going to talk about the different funding strategies. That won't be in today's module. That will be in the next module, module two. And then what is your exit strategy? So it's looking at all the potential exit strategies as well, which we'll cover in the deal analysis so that you know, if plan A doesn't work, then you have a plan B and even potentially a plan C. And that runs through the entire auction process. Whether it comes to selecting the property, you have your plan A properties, you have your plan B properties. And then down to the funding, you have your plan A funding, plan B funding. And then when it comes to the exit, how you're going to remortgage or whether you're going to sell the property, there's also plan A, plan B, and potentially plan C. So just to get an idea of where you are in your property journey. So the question is, have you ever invested in property? Other than buying your own home, if you have you ever, is to consider if you've ever bought in property, invested in property on sort of in a way to that's other than your house. So in a way that you wanted to use it to have a financial gain. And then what are you hoping to achieve through this process? Is it to build up a portfolio? Is it to get monthly recurring income? Is it to quit your job and transition full-time into property investing? Is it just a side investment? You have your day job, you're happy with your corporate work or business, and you just want it as a side investment to create your multiple streams of income? And then is it just to learn strategy for growing wealth? Because indeed buying property is one of the sort of most sound ways you can use to develop your portfolio and to grow long-term wealth as well as create recurring income in your current situation. So it's just wondering about your property journey and understanding where you are now and what you have to achieve. And one of the reasons why I ask, have you ever invested in property, is because the auction process is definitely specialized. So if you've purchased before, then you have sort of an idea of how it works. But if you haven't before, then the auction process has its own specialized methods and madness in a way that you've come to understand as we go through this lesson. So the agenda is to go over the fundamentals of auction purchasing, understanding the auction deal cycle, then a deep dive into the simple framework for sourcing, developing, and investing. And by investing, I mean, by the time you're done, you're able to extract the amount that you've, the initial capital into the deal. And then it's also selecting the right properties to force the appreciation. So we're going to do an analysis of the type of properties you should be looking at when you're evaluating in the auction. And then is reviewing the top auction strategies and then fundamentally the mistakes to avoid. So we're going to come to the mistakes quite early on in this so that you have an idea of some of the things to look out for when you're evaluating a property. So lesson one is the fundamentals of auction purchasing. So the number one thing about auction purchasing is the catalog. And this is a double wide spread of a typical auction catalog page. And where you'll see the address of the property, you'll see, you know, a brief description, you know, usually maybe one will be vacant or something, you know, they give a very light description of us around the property details. And in this case, it was a property that had planning already to extend and it was going to be a rare extension. Now, also it points you to the location of the property. So it says Halsden Roundwood Park, and then it's part vacant. And I'll come to this property later on when I'm talking about the freehold, the flying freehold, because this property ended up being one of those types of things. And you can see in the tenure, you'll see tenure says freehold. Now, this is also where you would find whether it's a leasehold, number of years left, which is also a very critical factor to look at when you're evaluating a property in the auction. And then it will give you kind of a brief description of the location, the closest stations, and then the location within the building. So this accommodation is a ground floor flat. It has three rooms, which includes, you notice there's nothing referenced in a living room because they're two bedrooms and one living room and they're all classified as rooms. And then you have your first floor. It also describes where in the building that it is. Indeed, actually, this is the ground floor flat, sorry. And the tenancy for the first floor is to let you know that that first floor flat actually is on a 99-year lease to somebody else, which I'll come back to later to explain what that means. And then it's to also notifying that planning has been granted on this. So that's what made this a really good deal, because for the price that I got it at, it already had planning to do the extension, which I didn't then have to wait another 6 to 8 to 12 weeks for that to be done. So that's just a brief synopsis of what you would see typically. And then top auction houses, because that screenshot that I showed you was from Savills. You have the top ones, which is Allsup, Baden Marcus, Andrew Robertson, the auction house is coming up as well, and then Stretton's, and there's so many other ones, and there's some that probably will argue that they should be on this list, but you know, these are the ones that I'm most familiar with, of which the two top ones are Allsup and Savills. And you can also get good lots as well, depending. And another thing with the auction houses as well, if you're going to focus on London, is that some of the properties are, some of the auction houses are area specific. So you'll find that some like Andrew Robertson, when I used to buy in Southeast London, I used to get good deals in Andrew Robertson. So it's also evaluating what areas they seem to be stronger in. And then there's another company called McHugh & Co, and they do better in Northwest London, if that's where you're looking. So it's also understanding where your patch is going to be and which auction house services that patch. So just have an understanding. But at the end of the day, it's really about looking through all the different auctions and just identifying which properties will work for your strategy. And then we'll go into talking about terminologies. Now, like I said, the auction process is completely, it has its own, you know, life cycle. It has its own terminologies. It's a world unto itself. So the catalog is the document, which is the first one I showed you, which releases all of the lots that the auctioneer has for sale. But then you have the lot numbers, which is a number assigned to a property. You have listings, which are pretty much a short description as you saw. And then you have an addendum. Now, addendum is usually after the fact. It's not included in the auction pack or in the auction original auction documentation, but then it's something that usually on the day of the auction or just prior last minute to the auction, you'll see an addendum. So typically when I used to go into the rooms before all of the COVID-19 happened, what happens is when you walk, the first thing you do is you go straight to the addendum board to see if your lots that you're, any of the lots that you're interested in is listed there, because there may be some changes. Maybe they'll add something like, oh, we've amended the price of the amount that the seller is asking for is now 1% of the value of property. There's different nuances and different changes that they could just include last minute, and that will be in the addendum. And then the special conditions of sale, you know, everyone that's in auctions knows about this and goes on, and you'll see throughout this whole presentation that there's a lot about special conditions of sale, because this is where they really try and sneak in all sorts of things into auctions, into the auction price. Because a lot of times you would think the price, you know, the details have, you know, are all included in the legal pack. But then as you go through the special conditions of sale, you find that there's some bits there that have not been included in legal pack, which, but you're still bound by, because it is part of the condition of the sale. So a very good example is, for instance, the sales, the seller usually will have legal costs attached to their selling the property, the cost of listing the property, the legal costs and all that. And they will try sometimes to pass it on to the buyer within the special conditions of sale. Now, it doesn't mean it's a no, you know, like it's a no deal. It just means that you're aware that there are extra costs that you need to factor in when you're doing your deal analysis to make sure that you don't, you know, you don't overbid. Because if, say, for instance, like the last property that I purchased from Westminster Council, when I went through special conditions of sale, I was shocked to find there was zero charges for the seller. The seller wasn't passing on any of their costs to the buyer, that is me. So I kept looking through, expecting to see, because it's standard, but in their case, they didn't have. So that was, in a way, a gain for me, because sometimes it can be up to 1%. I've even heard of it being 4%. And sometimes it can even be things like VAT included, which is not typical. And if VAT is included, it means that's an additional 20%, which pretty much kills the deal. So it's just to be aware of the special conditions of sale, just to go through it. And then the guide price is a very important price. You'll see that listed on all catalogs. And it's not really anything to do with the price. It just is, just usually I would say it's almost like a bait to get people to come through the door, to come and see the property, because they know ultimately that the reserve price is the real price. Now, a rule of thumb and something that I picked up from the whole process is that the guide price is usually within 10% of the reserve price. So it gives an estimate of where the buyer, the seller really wants to achieve. So because, as somebody explained, if there wasn't that 10% ceiling, then people would just put the guide price at £10 and then put the reserve price at some ridiculous price just to get people in. And then knowing fully well that until you bid to get to the reserve price, they're not going to sell. So the reserve price and the guide price, there's usually a 10%, there's usually a 10% differential between the two prices. And then the reserve price is actually a confidential price. Nobody's between, it's a confidential price set between the auctioneer and the seller. And it's usually confidential. They don't disclose that price to anyone. But once the guide price, once the bidding price on the day of the auction goes beyond the reserve price, then the seller is obligated to sell. So it's a confirmed purchase from there on. And then the bid, of course, as you know, is just you bidding on the property. It's an offer to buy the property at a specific price, and includes remote, internet, proxy, and proxy bidding is where the auctioneer is bidding on behalf. And then withdrawal during the bidding process, which has happened many times. You will notice, if when you start going to auctions, you will notice that a property would have started off at, say, maybe they say 300,000, and then it goes up to about 350, and then the auctioneer would just say, sorry, withdrawn. That means that somehow it didn't achieve the reserve price set by the seller. But that means there's also a deal to be had, because I've had that happen with one property. And immediately after that property was withdrawn from the auction, I ran to the front and then negotiated. So basically, this property was actually quite a cheap property on the east side of London. And I think the reserve price that the seller had put on there was £80,000. but we had bid up to 77 when the bid ended. So no, 75. It was 75 that we had bid up to, and then we didn't go. Nobody went beyond 75, and then it was like, okay, they withdrew the property. So when I went to the front, we then negotiated and eventually agreed at 77, which was kind of halfway. So just to understand that a withdrawal does not mean that it mean a withdrawal is an opportunity still for you to be able to buy that property. And then talking about the auction process, you know, and further down, you're going to see sort of more detailed, in-depth understanding of how it works. But once the catalog comes out, you know, that is the point where you take the catalogs from the auction houses, and everyone has them optimized online now so that you can actually search for the properties online. So the way I do it is that I usually will select based on my budget first before we even start, because there's no point looking. Although for sport, I do look at the more expensive properties because you just never know where the deal is. But realistically, I look at my budget. I consider my budget first. And then, so we'll go through the initial selection, pick out all the different lots within there that match the strategies that I think could work. And then we go through the viewing schedule. So prior to the auction, there will be viewing schedules, which due to COVID-19, some of these viewing schedules have been altered a bit. There was a period where there wasn't any viewing, but now viewings are allowed. It's just that the process is different, in that previously we could all just pile into the property and search, you know, there'll be like 10 of us in the property at the same time. Now it's almost where you can only have one or two people at any point in time viewing, and then everybody else queues outside. So that's the process. And then you arrange your funding while this is going on, because you want to be pre-approved and know what your max budget is, because that is also going to inform what you're going to bid up to. And then shortlisting the final. So, you know, you after you've gone to view the property, you then shortlist which properties match and meet your strategy and what you're trying to achieve in terms of price, in terms of your budget, in terms of the layout of the property, which we're all going to come down to what the criteria is. And then you attend the auction and then hopefully win. And then we have strategies for if you don't win as well. And then you carry on to completing the finance and the legal, because at this point you have the legal pack, you have your finance already pre-arranged, so you contact your broker and the legal team to start, because you only have 28 days once the hammer goes down, of which that is day one of the hammer going down. So, you know, it really, time is very critical. And then hopefully everything has gone well, and 28 days or between 28 and 35 days later, you are picking up the keys to the property. And then pretty much the cycle starts again. So it's just understanding that that's how the auction process works. And then with the auction deal completion timelines, this is a very important slide, because it kind of explains to you how the process works. So typically, if you were buying a property in the market, it could take you 12 weeks or 16 weeks, something ridiculous like that, because they're going through the motions. But in the auction, in fact, most times, if you're speaking to a broker and you're going to buy an auction, you have to let them know, because they will then be able to determine which finance company is best for you to use. Because if you use the wrong finance company and they're just wasting time in the process, it can really cost you the 10% deposit. So that's why I titled it How Not to Lose Your 10% Deposit, because from the point where the hammer goes down, where you've won the property, you have the 10% deposit that you've deposited on that day, and you know it comes out of your bank account that day. And you have the 90%, which you have a portion of it, which will go towards your own deposit, which will typically be about 25% of the total value. So you still have another 15% to deposit, which should be somewhere resident inside either a savings account or somewhere where your mortgage lender can see, because they are going to ask for it. So that's your 25%. But then the 75% portion, which you're going to get from the lender, from the mortgage, or from the bridging finance, and we're going to talk about all the different funding structures and funding sources you can have. Now that 75%, you need to make sure that they're on track. So this is why this auction deal completion timeline is completely vital. Hammer goes down and day one, you send off your legal pack and confirm with your broker ASAP. Everybody gets the ball rolling. And somehow, because everybody knows it's auctions, everybody's more efficient. The process works better. And I said, this is why I said, it's a really good process for scaling up your business if you're going to go down the business route, because you almost can't predict with timelines. I'm going to come to that too. So once you sent off the legal pack, you then have week one and two for them to do their due diligence and then instruct the valuation. At the point where they've not instructed the valuation by the end of week two, then one should really be getting worried, because after valuation, there's still a turnaround time. Sometimes it can be 2 days, it could be up to a week for them to check the valuation and then issue out the offer, right? And the offer comes out and then your legals are instructed. So it's important that if you notice that it's slipping and by week two, the valuation hasn't been instructed, then you know it's going to impact on your legals. And unless the legal company is really quick, as in the legal firm is very quick and can turn around in 2-3 days, which has happened, by the way, sometimes if you're just following the normal process, then you should instantly be looking at your option B. And this is why I said, once you realize that these deadline dates are slipping, it's time for plan B. So usually you have, the only problem with plan B is that it's usually more expensive than plan A. And we're going to come to deal, when you're doing the deal analysis, the different funding sources. So I've been in a situation before where I was about to lose the 10%, so I had to go for plan B. It was more expensive. And by the way, when I say more expensive, it's marginally more expensive, but it is more expensive ultimately, especially when you're looking at percentages of the deal, in which case maybe plan A was 1% of the total value of the mortgage that I was borrowing. This one could be 1.5% or 2%. But when compared to losing 10% of the overall deal, then, you know, it's a no-brainer that I would still want to take this extra one or, you know, 1 or 0.5% deal just to make sure that I protect the 10% that I've already deposited. And I always say that it's not just the 10% that you lose, which is extremely painful. It's also the fact that you've searched and finally found a property that stacks up. Everything works out. And then you're also losing on the ongoing. So you lose out on the fact that you found a good property that has value in it. Then you lose out on the recurring income from that property at that time. Because even if you were to find another property, that's still another 2 months for the auction cycle to come through. And hopefully you find another property. So there is a general loss, opportunity cost loss as well. So it's just understanding sometimes why, you know, in addition to 10%, there's also that feeling of this deal has to work. And which is why very few of these deals actually fall through. Like, it has to really get to the crunch that you lose your 10%. And in the 10 years I've been doing it, I've lost 10% once. And it wasn't my 10%, thankfully. It was my client's 10% because, you know, I wasn't informed until the day before we were going to auction that he wasn't going to be able to complete on his own side of the deal. But anyway, so that's a different story. But for the most part, there are all these different strategies to be able to overcome that. So you go to week four, which is the completion week. And then gratefully and thankfully, there is week five, which is when notice is served. So if, say, for instance, something happens and dates are slipping and you can't make the 28-day deadline, it's not the end of the world. You don't lose the 10% on 28 days. You still have an extra 10 days most of the time. But it's good to check the legal pack to make sure that it's in there. So I always check to make sure there is notice going to be served for 10 days, because that gives me an additional, that means I have in total about 38 days, which is about 6 weeks, which is okay. No, just over 5 weeks, sorry. So which is okay. So that no matter what happens, even if I had to get plan B or even plan C, it should be fine. And then once all of that is done, then you pick up the keys. So now, but notice that the 10-day notice period is charged at a daily percentage rate. Sometimes it's 0.2%. So it's not too much. At the end of the 10 days, usually maybe I paid £200 on you know, the extra time. But that's fine. I'm happy to pay it because I've just saved myself the 10%. So it's just to give you an idea of the completion times. And of course, one of the main benefits of buying an auction is just because it's so predictable. You have your 28-day cycle. There's 20 working days. Mm-hmm. It helps you to plan as a business. You can plan your property acquisition strategy in month one. This is January. Okay, there are no auctions in January. So maybe February we start. You know, I get a property then. I know that if I'm going to do a simple strategy, I'll be out of that deal in 6 months. If I can get funding from an investor, then I can go into the next deal cycle of the auction in another month and a half or 2 months, and then start that process. So it really makes it very fluid in that you can create a whole cycle around this 28 days rather than waiting months and months for a property on the market to try and go through the normal process. And then also discounted prices. So there have been amazing, amazing deals found in auction. I remember at the beginning of this process for me, one of the deals that I found, which I still regret to today because I didn't actually go for the auction. I just thought, oh, this property is just too amazing. There were so many people. There was a line around the block to buy the property, sorry, to view the property. And then on the day of the auction, the property price didn't actually go beyond much more than the guide price, which means it must have just crossed the reserve price. So when I saw the price at the end, I was really, really surprised, and because it was such an achievable price. So this was for a very central London property as well. So it's one of those things, you can really get good deals. The first property I ever found in auction that I bought without seeing, which I completely do not recommend, but it was a good deal because I had seen the building before. I'd gone into the building for another person that I knew who had bought a property in that building. And the person bought the property for about £90,000 more than was going in the auction. So that was another reason why it was a good deal. So, you know, depending on when in the cycle, like now, I would say it's a more difficult time than maybe even last year. There were still deals to be had last year. Over the COVID period, because none of the other estate agents were working and only auctions were live online, they really did very well over the COVID lockdown period. So in that period, it wouldn't have been the best strategy, but normally you get really good discounts in the auction. And then there's no risk of gazumping. Nobody can take the property from you. There can't be a higher bid or higher price offered later on in which the buyer then withdraws your own offer and says, look, I'm going with the higher offer. And then it's an open process. For the most part, it is quite open. So there are some deals that go sort of before they even get to the auction catalog, where they've already kind of been sold off. But most of the properties do get to the auction catalog. And if you are that interested in the property, you can always put in an offer before the property goes to the auction. It's very rare that it will be accepted, but you know, an offer, there are many times when offers have been accepted prior to auction, just because the owners are just looking to sell and they don't want to risk going to the auction room and then it not selling as at a high enough price. So for the most part, you know, if you are that interested in a property, it is recommended to put in an offer prior to going to the room. And then no long chains. With normal purchases, sometimes you find a situation where somebody needs to sell a property before you can actually buy the property. But then in this case, there's no risk of that sort of failure. And then there's unlimited access. So typically you may not know an area, and it would come up on the auction. If you go and do your area research, you find out, oh, this is a really good deal for the price. And then it may be an area that you wouldn't have normally considered, but because you've followed the money, as I say, where you've just done your analysis, notice that, ooh, there is some, you know, there is potential for good, you know, valuation with this property and whatever strategy you want to employ, then, you know, it kind of gives you access to whatever properties are in the market. You're not limited to any location. So we come to the easy mistakes, and all of this is just the setup as we go into what you need to do to buy in auction. Because these mistakes are, you know, the 8 mistakes to avoid. And the reason why I say it does not include buying blind is because I know people who have bought blind. I have also bought blind. And buying blind is where you haven't seen the property, you haven't gone to view it, and you just see it in the auction. It's just an amazing price. And you're like, I'm just going to take the risk. Now, that is very, very rare that it happens, and is definitely a risky strategy. But sometimes you know the area so well, or you know the building so well. So, you know, if it's a flat within a building, then chances are, you know, it's not going, especially if it's a purpose-built building, then there may not be anything else that you need to really worry about. So you can just quickly scan the legal pack and decide, look, this property looks fine, I'll bid on it. So so that's just a quick note about buying blind, but it's not recommended. Now, one of the reasons why I said these are these easy mistakes, because they're more fundamental mistakes coming down the line, but these are the first mistakes that are potentially that can happen. And the reason why I have this as number one is a lot of times you go to the auction because you have this one property that makes sense and makes financial sense. But actually, if you want to run it as a business, and you need that steady flow, then sometimes you may sacrifice having 50% margins in a deal to having, say, 20, because the deal still works. So it's good to have these different options that are based around the best case scenario, the worst case scenario. And the one I showed you, which was the first property that I showed you with in the catalog, that property was my second choice in an auction, 2 years ago. And my first choice was a beautiful second floor flat in a really nice part of town. But I also was very aware that there was going to be a lot of competition because I'd gone to view that property 3 times. And every time I'd gone, there were many people viewing it. So I said, this property is going to be very, very popular. When I went to view this property, however, there was only 1 or 2 other people viewing the property. So I then did the math and said, well, rather than stick all my eggs in this one basket where potentially, and that's exactly what happened, is that everybody was bidding. In fact, I suspect that out of 5 people in that property, in that auction, every one person out of 5 was there for that property. So, and they were, you know, so it was just a very sought after property. And so if I'd gone with just that one, then I wouldn't have left with anything. But then this deal ended up being a really, really good deal because I kept my eyes open for having other options. And then not setting realistic budgets. And I put this there because I know people that say things like, oh, you know, this is a Notting Hill property. It's listed at 450. I'm only going to bid to 500. But that's unrealistic because the property prices in that area on a normal day are about 700. So there's nobody in the auction room who's going to allow you to walk away. It happens, but it's very rare for a really good centrally located property to go at a really ridiculous price. You know, it just has to be maybe in December or sometime random like that. Because what happens is there are some people that are just in the room looking for these opportunities. So if they see that the property is going at some ridiculous price, they will just put up their hands. And I have been that kind of person as well, where I came sort of speculatively looking, and then a property that I had done the deal analysis was going for much less than I thought it would. And then you kind of just bid and hope for the best afterwards because it's such a good price. So having low budget and unrealistic prices mean that you'll never win in the auction. You need to have a realistic pricing strategy in which you can still make good money and keep the engine running. And then also getting emotional, of course, that has to be there because it does happen. And sometimes they say you should go to auctions with someone because it is a very emotional experience. I don't know how to explain it. Maybe that's why the people that buy in auction like buying in auction, because the whole thing just has, it has a different sort of charge to it. So, you know, one thing I did pick up a few years ago, and I realized, and I didn't realize that it was actually a thing, and that's why I put it there, that if you realize that you are bidding and it's only you and one other bidder, because usually with the auctions, everybody's bidding at the same time. You know, one person's bidding, then the second person, and the third person. At some point, it just becomes you and whoever, especially if you the deal is still working within the pricing that you've come up with. So in my case, because I'm always adding value, I'm able to bid maybe a bit higher than maybe the typical person. And many times people have come to me and said, oh, you paid too much for that property. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't. I know what I'm going to use that property for, right? So it's also about being creative with the strategies, which I'm going to show you further down. So now when you're bidding, if you find out that you and this person are bidding and it's just both of you bidding, at some point you have to come to your senses and realize you're now bidding the price completely out of the actual market price. And if it works with your strategy, then you can continue. But if at some point you realize you're going way beyond your max budget, then that's the point to scale back and walk away from the deal because it needs to work out as a deal. So my rule of thumb is I'll have the max. If it's a property I really want, maybe because of the location, then I will have like another maybe 10% on top of it. But at that point, no matter what's happening, I'll walk away because I now know that it's completely out of spec. So it's completely out of, I'm not going to make as much, and there's no guarantees that I'll be able to reduce my costs to be able to make up for the difference. And then not checking the completion dates is number 4, because typically, as I said, the 28 days plus the extra 10 days in most cases, but sometimes there could be special clause, and again, special condition of sale, it will be on there that this lot is a 14-day completion. I've seen that happen many times where it's actually a shorter completion, so I've just walked away because it's already stressful enough in the 28 days, not to talk of you now, unless you're a cash buyer, 14 days is very difficult, but there are lots of bridging companies that will do it within 14 days. They just cost a lot. Like I said, the plan Bs usually cost a lot more. And then you have also 6 to 8 weeks, which is a good thing, but sometimes it's on there and you just have to estimate that into your timelines as well, because if they want to complete in 6 to 8 weeks, then it obviously impacts when you're going to pick up the keys and when you're going to have your work done and, you know, and the entire sort of auction cycle. And then number five, so this is where we're now going into the real core mistakes to avoid, because the first three, first four were sort of simple, but this one, as I've mentioned throughout, is not reading the special condition sale, which sounds like it should be obvious, but a lot of people actually forget to, and there's so many clauses that could be slipped in there. So I explained the difference where you have the general conditions of sale, which is standard condition of sale, and I think sometimes some people take that to be the special condition of sale, because that generally has all of the standard procedure and the terms like contracts, when, what to do if you're a successful bidder, all of those different aspects of a standard auction purchase. But then the special conditions, then, as I said, have some additional charges that could be levied against the buyer, could have hidden clauses. Sometimes it has to do with maybe there's a huge service charge bill sort of in the next financial year in which the buyer is going to be liable for their previous charges on the property that have not been paid that the buyer will be responsible for. So some of those special conditions could be hidden within this part of the document, as well as the VAT, as I mentioned before, which can impact the price of the property and impact on your profit. And then number six is not checking the lease length. Now, when we started, I showed you where you would find the lease length. It's not all auction catalogs that have the lease length so obviously listed like that. Most of them will have it on that page, but I've definitely seen where there was a property just a few months ago that I noticed was in Harrow, a beautiful two-bed property. And one of the reasons why I didn't go for it was because I noticed I had about 50-something years on the lease left. But then at the auction, I saw somebody bidding for the property and I was like, oh, wow, I guess this person must be a cash buyer, or because I know that a 50-year-old lease is very difficult to get a mortgage on. So bid and everything. And then I went into the next auction cycle, I then noticed that property was back on the market. So which, you know, there are many reasons why that could be, but I felt like it probably was down to the person not necessarily knowing to look at the lease length. And thereby, you know, so it's completely speculative on me, but I know it's a big thing that happens a lot of times where people don't look at the lease length, which a lot of times could be just maybe 4 or 5 years left on the lease. And it's because of the way it's also worded. A lot of times it's 99 years from. So if you're just scanning, you might see 99 years and think it's 99 years, but it's actually saying 99 years from 2000 and, you know, 1955 or something, so that by the time you calculate the difference of 99 years from 1955, you realize you only have about, 30 years left or something. So it's just being aware of that. So understanding the way buildings work, you know, the different types of buildings you find in an auction, you sometimes will find buildings that are just freeholds. Sometimes you find a flat that will be a share of freehold within the auction as well. So it will just be, it will have, you know, a lot of years within the lease because it's a share of leasehold, there's a share of freehold. And then typically leases can be anywhere from 999, which is a great lease length because it's almost like you're getting a long-term, like a freehold without necessarily having the freehold. And then typically as well, you see 125 years or 99 years from a date. So it's always important to check what that date is. And then short leases are typically anything below 70 years. You struggle to get funding anywhere from 80 years, but you can get within 70 and 80 years. It's just that it gets, there are fewer and fewer lenders that will. But some people use short leases as a strategy. I have a family member that just does short leases, and then they go through the process of extending, because that is a strategy in itself, which I will come to later as well. And then this is very important on mortgageable properties. And I've almost had a bad experience with one of these, and that's why I listed it as the first one, where it was a living space without a window. And whilst my job as part of my refurbishment was going to knock a window into that wall and create a living room, that property did not qualify for a mortgage. And it was valued by two separate surveyors who came and said, it's not a mortgageable property. And I said, but I'm just going to knock the window through it, and then it's going to become a mortgageable property. And they were like, sorry, as it is now, we can't lend on it because it's not. So it ended up having to be a cash buyer. I'm only grateful that it was a very cheap property, so I was able to raise the cash through private funding, which is one of the different funding sources that we'll come to later. And because a lot of people are really into property and understand the value of property, property investing, finding private lenders when you come to a crunch is not as difficult as you would think. So that's always like the plan X. It's like, if everything goes wrong, if you put out even just in general, like investor network meetings, you just start going to different ones and just saying, look, I have this deal I'm about to lose. They'll probably come up with some very expensive bailout clause, but at least you'll save the property. So that's worst case scenario. There are many other strategies that you would do leading up to that. Anyway, living spaces without windows is a big one, because you could see a nice studio that's a large studio, but if it doesn't have windows on either side, then it will not qualify. Sometimes property sizes below 30 square meters, it's very rare to find this, but sometimes you find it in sort of central London, which, as you can tell from this, that's kind of the area, like zone 2, zone 3, that sort of areas, my patch in London. But then another thing that I wanted to bring out from this is also room sizes. So sometimes if you had a strategy to do a HMO and you did your analysis and you thought, oh, I could be able to get 6 rooms from this property, but which one of the bedrooms did not meet the minimum requirements, then you could also be knocked back in your valuation, because rather than it being valued as a 6-bedroom property, they will value as a 5-bedroom property, because they will knock back that room that doesn't meet the minimum standard size of a bedroom. So it's just keeping those types of things aware when you're looking at room sizes and looking at dimensions within the property. And then, of course, structural defects. That's like the most common reason why properties are unmortgageable. If there's subsidence, if there's movements, if there's cracks. And those are usually noticeable because they are usually very, very deep cracks in the wall. So the simple hairline cracks you see, for the most part, are simple. They're just movements within the building, and that's fine. But when you see a deep crack where you're seeing the bricks, then you know this is an issue. And then flying freeholds, the example I was given where that's exactly the same property that was listed at the beginning, where it's a freehold flat, which I was very excited to get because I thought, oh, wow, freehold flat. You never see those. You only see leasehold flats. But then when it came to mortgaging, actually, the first mortgage was very easy because it was bridging. But when it came to remortgaging, I'd gone quite far in the process with one of the mortgage lenders who had a specific clause in there saying, will not qualify for freehold flats. And I was like, I don't understand why. And then there was explanation about mortgage lenders not liking the fact that there's another property within the building that's not under their remit, but then you still have the freehold of that building. So it's sort of a complicated scenario, but there are lenders that don't really care about that. They know that all they need to do is to just convert it to a leasehold, and then they can sell it if anything goes wrong and you can't pay your mortgage. So, you know, there are different types of lenders in the market, and different lenders will have different risk appetites. Some of them don't mind that they're going to take the property over if you don't pay the mortgage. And some of them mind that the property will not be something that they can easily just sell. So it's all about the lender's own risk appetite as well. And then this is also very key, a non-functioning bathroom or kitchen. So a lot of times you look at a property and you think, oh, because it has a standard bathroom and it has a kitchen in it, but if they're not working or there's something like, say for instance, the toilet or the sink has been dislocated or is not connected, then the mortgage companies will come in and say, this is not a property that somebody can habitable straight away. and they will sometimes not lend on it. But those are more standard mortgage companies. Most bridging companies and most of the companies that lend to property developers will understand that that will be fixed as part of the process. So it's just understanding where your funding sources are going to be coming from. If you find a normal property, a nice property that maybe has a kitchen and a bathroom, and you found a good deal on it, you can have normal lending go through. You can go through normal lending, which is much cheaper than bridging finance. And so it's just understanding that the timelines, just understanding that you need to make sure that they can match the auction timelines, and that they're okay with the property not being completely at a good spec, right? So it's just understanding what the requirements are per lender. And then other issues. What happened? Hi. And then, sorry, I'm going to just start that. And then other issues like asbestos, absentee landlords, where this absentee landlords is where the landlord does not exist in the property. Like, it's a leasehold property, but then they can't find the freeholder. Maybe the freeholder has passed away and it's supposed to automatically revert to the crown. There are all of these terminologies around absentee landlords, and some lenders don't like that, but some lenders don't care either. So it's really about the right lender. But what happens with all these different issues is that it limits the number of people that you can get funding from. Sorry, just one second. Okay. So that covers all of the issues. And then, of course, illegal tenants and squatters, that covers all the other issues that you can potentially face. And then poor due diligence, and that's the eighth mistake to avoid, is where you have poor estimates on a refurb or a development. So, and it can impact profitability, and you can really run into difficulties. So it's making sure that when you're looking at a refurb, that you get qualified people to look at it. So if you have a builder in mind to do the job, then on one of the scheduled viewing dates, you get that builder in there so he can give you an estimate or at least a rough pricing, especially when you're starting out. As you do a few more of these, then you'll start to have an idea of, okay, this is how much it costs to replace a bathroom. This is how much it costs for this person, because, you know, these costs also vary depending on who you have. So if you have to select the right builder that will be able to bring in these costs at a good price so that you can make a good margin. So at this point, I've now developed a good relationship with the builder who, you know, I can send him on the auction viewing and be like, look, go and see that property and give me a general price of what you think it will be. And now I actually can just look at the property and be like, okay, this is how much he's going to charge me as well. So it's just making sure you have the right estimates on a refurb and a development. And just, you know, and especially if you're going to go into HMOs and the larger developments, you know, with the lofts and the extensions, those prices can really, really range all over the place, especially depending on the builder you're using. Sometimes, and this is why I talk about strategies to deal with builders, because it is a thing. Builders, especially when they know you're new to property investing and development, they can really try it on in terms of the way they, you know, for the most part, you know, I've had good builders, but some builders will really just try and take advantage of the fact that you don't always know the costings of things. So, you know, and it can really affect your profitability. And then incorrect property valuations. So this, I say, is around area dynamics. So, you know, there are some streets that are priced higher than other streets. And this especially is if you're going to go into outside London where you don't maybe know the nuances of those areas, is making sure that you call and speak to as many estate agents as possible. And I'll come to some of the things you should do when you're buying an auction to avoid these issues. So some of the local price differences in an area where you think a property should sell at, say, you've done the math, you think it should be £110,000, but actually on that street, it's actually 90. So you buying it at 75, 80, doing works, so you've only just come to the price that a normal person would buy it off the market. So that's not a good deal. So making sure you're very clear on the property valuation. And then incorrect estimates on finance fees. And that's a big one. And I've gotten caught out on that as well, where you know, because their cost to go into a deal, their cost to exit that deal, their cost to go into the next remortgage deal, and you know, at the end when you're exiting from those deals, and those costs really do stack up. So I've had some really, really good projects, you know, even the project from last year, which was a really good project. By the time I estimated how much I had to pay in fees, because one of my lenders disappointed me, which, by the way, as you realize, I'm a big fan of plan B, plan B, plan B, is because of the experiences I've had where they will just pull out. So this lender actually pulled out because of COVID-19, and you know, his deal was much better than my plan B lender, but because my plan B lender was going to save this deal and not get me into paying £9,000 a month for penalties, you know, I just took the deal because it made a lot of sense. So, but it still was more expensive and definitely has eaten into the profits. So the way I'll work that out is to hold that property for slightly longer than I plan to, because I know that the market hopefully will pick up over time and then I can make the funds back that way. So, you know, there are different strategies around this. You may give up a bit in your finance fees, knowing fully well you can wait a bit to recoup that cost. You know, and we're going to go into all of the fees, what makes up the fees, you know, the stamp duty, all of the different fees to be aware of when you're doing your deal packaging. And then, so that's incorrect estimates on finance fees and understanding the entry and the exit fees from a deal especially. And then I thought it was important to put in that auctions work very well with the BRRR method. And if you don't know what the BRRR method is, it's where you buy, B stands for buy, and then you refurbish, you refinance, or you rent. So it's, you know, I guess it depends on the way you look at it. So you buy, refurbish, you rent, you remortgage or refinance. So, and that is a very good strategy, and it's increasingly, especially in this market, and especially in a market that is deemed to be a down market, it's a great strategy for building your portfolio. So if you're already coming in where you already have a pot of cash, you can recycle that cash very easily using this process. And that deal that I showed you again was a really good example of how you could go into a deal. It cost a lot, but by the time we revalued it, I was able to add an additional 200,000 to the price because I converted from a one bed to a three bed. So by the time I'm revaluing it, then I'm taking out most of the amount that I've invested in. I think I left about 11 or 12,000 in that deal. And then I have the rest to be able to roll into another project. So it's important when you're looking at properties that you are assessing how much is going to be left back in the deal. And by the way, you know, having a certain large amount within the deal. When I say large, I mean like, as opposed to being able to extract 100%, you were able maybe to extract maybe 75%, is still fine, because the amount that's left in is the cash that's in that deal. And when you look at that cash versus your rental yield, then you find out a lot of times, as long as you're making more than 20%, and I'll come to how you calculate all of these numbers, as long as you're over 20%, it's usually a good deal, because that same cash in the bank is earning 0%. In today's market. So, you know, you're making 20% on the cash that's left in the property based on the rent that you're getting from that property. It's a good deal. And you would still go into that sort of deal. So it's just understanding what makes a good deal. And, you know, but the goal, you know, the golden rule is to try and extract as much as you can from the deal. And so this is why I say auctions are perfect with BRRR, because the timelines are very short. You buy the property month one, you know, month one, you're viewing the property, you're going to check your shortlisting, then you go into month two, where you have auction day, you know, then you go into, you know, your conveyancing, financing, and you pick up the keys pretty much at the end of month two. You have month 3 to 5 for refurb, which depends on what type of refurb you're doing. To be fair, it could also be longer, which I come to later on. It could be longer depending if you're doing a loft, you're doing an extension, it could be 5-6 months, but it doesn't really matter because you're still going to be able to extract all that money out. And then you refinance at the end. So this is with a simple BRRR method. By month 5-6, you've already refurbished, you've rented the property, and now you can refinance and release as much equity from the deal to move into a new cycle in month 7. So this is just a round replicating circle. So that's pretty much understanding the fundamentals of auction properties. You know, all of the terminologies, you have an idea of the cycle, you have an idea of the best practices, what not to do, what to avoid. Now we're going into how you buy auction properties using the simple framework. And simple, which I'm going to break it out into, pretty much goes into sourcing the property, increasing the value of the property, modifying the property, presenting the property, letting out the property or leasing it out, and then extracting the value. So it's effectively the same buy, refurbish, refinance model, but it's broken out so that you can understand how each of the different aspects work. So when you're looking to source the property, you're looking to select the right property. So when we come to sort of looking at an auction catalog, you're always going to be qualifying the property based on the price, based on the location. And, you know, it depends on whether you feel like it's a location that is either close to you or it's a location that the valuations really work. That's a personal choice. And you're happy to do the long commute, but because the valuation works. So I know people who will leave London and go all the way to sort of Nottingham or Birmingham or those types of locations because they're able to get the right valuations from the deals that they find up there, and their money goes further for them. Some of us would prefer to do it more locally because of access and wanting not to travel too long. So it's all about your own personal choices as well. And then the strategy, of course, is important. And we're going to come to the different strategies that you could use to uplift a property's value. But it's very important when you're picking the location that you're also thinking of the strategy, will it work? A good example is serviced accommodation, which is one of the strategies that I've employed, is where you do up the property, you pick a nice location, which is not maybe central because it's too expensive, but just outside of central, but easy access. And then you know that location works for that strategy because it's very close to the station. It means you'll be able to get a lot more rent than if you just rented it out. And sometimes the rent differential is quite high, where maybe if you just rented it to a standard family, they'll be paying $1,200 a month or $1,300 a month. Meanwhile, the same property on serviced accommodation will be at $800, $900 per week, right? So it's just thinking about, okay, what is my long-term goal? Am I looking for cash or am I looking for peace of mind? Because there's usually an inverse relationship between the two. So it's also understanding what the strategy is. If you're in a high income, I want to earn as much income from my property as much as I can phase, then that's to you consider that. Or if you're in I just want a passive business, then you just put in it's standard family where they'll be paying their rent and there won't be any more to it. And then of course, selecting the right property is down to the condition. And the condition is really because of the pricing and the valuation around the cost of refurbishing the property. So if the condition is such that you have to do a complete guts job, clean, you know, remove walls, you know, put in new walls, then you have to consider that as part of your pricing. And I've had a property like that where I estimated the cost, you know, I was just going to change the bathroom, the kitchen, and maybe do some painting. And I estimated the cost to be about maybe about 25,000. And then by the time the builder came, he said, well, all the walls here are rotten. So that was an additional like 5,000 or 7,000 that I hadn't budgeted because he had to take out all the walls. So it's that kind of thing where it's, you know, and that's why it's important to have a builder going, because this was quite early on in my journey where I didn't think about the walls being an issue. The walls were there, they looked fine, but by the time he started knocking, he just showed me, like, by the time he knocked through it, it just crumbled. And he said, yeah, you can leave it like this, but I promise you in a few months you're going to call me back. So, you know, you sometimes you just have to make that judgment call, and which is why it's important. If I'd taken the builder prior, then he would have picked up on that. I could have done my estimates better. And then the layout, and we're going to come to layout under modification, which is the M in the simple process, because the layout is so important. I'll explain. And when we go into deal analysis, you see how the layout can make such a big difference in a simple project where you can uplift the value by so much just because you've reconfigured the layout. And then we come to the rental and sales comparables. And this is what I'm talking about, the sales, making sure you're comparing like for like when you're looking at the valuations of the properties, also with the rental, because that's also happened where you look at a general area, search on Rightmove, and you see these really good rental values. And then on that street, rental values don't quite match or stack up. So also being very clear on the local area. So when you're looking, so this is all of the pre-auction process. You know, you're sourcing a property, and part of the process of sourcing a property is shortlisting and qualifying. And this is really the step-by-step review of the catalog. So this is almost what you would take looking at the catalog, and you look at the catalog lots and sort by price. So that's what I do. I will look at the catalog, sort by price, and select the properties that work within my budget. Then I'll qualify the properties that meet my criteria. So for instance, I'm always looking at layout next. If the layout, and when I come to the layout, you see what I mean, where if the layout doesn't work, I just park it and move it off of my list. And then I go to the next. And I do that because I don't want to go and view all the properties. I want to select the properties that actually meet my criteria for strategy. Then I can go and start looking, because you're wasting your time otherwise. It's good, you know, good practice maybe at the beginning just to see a few properties that maybe you wouldn't typically have gone to look at, just to see what it ends up as a price and to be able to do good valuation later, so that you say, oh, if this type of property comes to the market, this is typically how much it sells for in this area. It's good for area analysis. But beyond that, there's just no point. If you're going to select a type of property because you know the strategy that you want, then you can just select the properties that match that criteria, and it saves you a lot of time. And then on this side, because remember, you haven't seen the property yet, so you just go through the legal pack. Legal packs are usually up on the website within 2 or 3 days. Sometimes it takes longer, and I keep those properties in check because I'm never going to bid on. In fact, I would sooner bid on a property I haven't seen before that had all of its paperwork intact than bid on a property that I've seen but didn't have its legal paperwork on, you know, and then I was expected to bid on it and buy it without seeing the legal documentation. I wouldn't do that. So it's evaluate and check for any potential issues that you spot in the paperwork. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you, you know, you have like a standard education, you should be able to read through just the simple legal packs and spot if there's anything that you need to be worried about. If something doesn't sound right or doesn't look right. And then at the beginning, you can find lawyers that will scan these documents, maybe a friend, or maybe even if you had to pay a little token amount, just to scan the documents for you to make sure that the documents stack up. And, you know, because there's some standard documentation you expect with every conveyancing. And then it's then after that, once you've just shortlisted, then you can attend the viewings and further shortlist your list, especially in auctions where you have about 200 or 300 properties, where it's such a full auction and you found different, you sometimes found up to 20 properties that fit the bill. But by the time you go and view them, you realize, well, this is not going to work, or this one has this issue, or the access to the properties, you know, or the area, the different reasons why you would just whittle it down. And then usually you have like the top 4 or 5. And sometimes I've only had 2. I typically say it's better to go with 3, but 2 is fine because you hopefully you can walk away. Otherwise, then you walk away from the deal, from the auction, and you didn't get anything that cycle. And then you check the legal documentation and the special clauses, check for vacant possession, check if the property is empty. And, you know, sometimes it will say it in documentation, just on the page, it will say whether it's regulated tenancy or it's tenanted. Now, regulated tenancies are important because they are priced, they're capped tenancies. So there's it's usually maybe for elderly people. There are usually all these reasons why people qualify for regulated tenancy. But what that means is that the tenancy is usually significantly lower than what the market price is. So if you buy a property with a regulated tenancy in it, you might not be able to get a mortgage because the deal will not stack up. So we're going to come to how you make sure that the rental valuation works with the price of the property, because sometimes you're in a situation where you've uplifted the value of the property. Say you've added the property, let's say you bought it at 200K, you've done some work to it and you've now added the value and now 350. But the rental for the new valuation may not help you take out all of the funds. With those amounts that I just told you about, the 200, 350, usually in London, it will be fine. But if you go into sort of the 400, 500K mark, that's where you're likely to find it being an issue. So it's just to keep that in mind for when you start buying property, to make sure that you do the rental. The rental valuation also forms a very important part of your deal analysis. And then we come into, this is still part of the pre-auction process, the viewing process, and it's the step-by-step review of the property. So you're looking at the building internally and externally, looking for defects, cracks, and really it's all about helping you to understand the scope of the works. So, you know, there's some things that you should take along with you, things like, you know, having a measuring tape, or if you don't have a measuring tape, have a way you measure. Like, so sometimes I use my, like, I know how to count my feet and then count the number of feet in a room now. But originally I would have like a measuring tape or have a laser, which are very cheap to get on Amazon. And you can just use that to measure up the rooms because you want to know if you can modify the rooms to add the value. So at the end of the day, you're looking at scope of works. You're trying to understand sometimes what works you need to do. If you need to get a new boiler, if you need new windows, maybe the windows are completely cracked or the wood around the windows are rotten. If you need to replace the windows, because that's all going to eat into your bottom line. So understanding that's what you're going, when you're doing the viewing, is understanding what you need to look out for. And I have a checklist of what you should be looking out for, which I'll provide at the end of the next module. And then checking that the dimensions to the strategy. Remember I was saying, especially with HMOs, to make sure that you have the room sizes that will meet the minimum room sizes expected by the mortgage company that's going to come and revalue the property, because you don't want a situation where you've expected you're going to get a 6-bed valuation and then it's knocked back. And then evaluate and check for any potential issues physically in the building. So externally, internally, you're constantly checking for any issues. And then if you can, multiple viewings. And the reason is because on the first viewing, you'll see the viewing calendar. The first viewing really is about you assessing if this is a deal or not. Once you've done that, then the second and third viewing, if you're serious, is really to make sure that the surveyor goes in there, or your builder or a structural engineer, to evaluate for anything. So if it's a property you walk in and everything looks fine, and you know, most of the time if it's a London property, externally no cracks, internally no cracks, then you don't have to have builders or it will be very unfortunate if there was something fundamental wrong. It's one of those things that shouldn't really happen. But if you see anything that just raises alarm bells, you know, and you know, that's why the checklist is there, to help you to kind of, it's a guide. It's not obviously completely exhaustive of every single property problem you would find in property, but it'll help you kind of, okay, if you see a crack here, if you see this, these are the type of things that you should call a secondary person. If generally you walk in and you're just not comfortable, maybe the floors are leaning funny or something, then just call somebody. It's worth the amount that you'll save in the long run. And then check in the neighborhood. Sometimes there's the advice to go in the day and in the night. So, you know, if you're driving by the area, just to make sure that the area does stack up to the area that you saw when you went during the viewing at night. Because when people are viewing to rent a property, especially if you're going to do a long-term rental, they're coming in the evenings after work sometimes, at least when things go back to normal. And so if the neighborhood is just diminished somehow, then it then can impact on the price of the property. So it's just having that awareness as well. And then of course, step-by-step review of the paperwork. So the previous one was step-by-step review of the property. And this is now the due diligence around the paperwork. So reviewing the legal documentation I mentioned a number of times through, especially special clauses, contacting local estate agents for in-depth analysis. Remember, you have already done your own analysis, but because you might not always be up to date on what is going locally, estate agents, calling different ones for an area that you're unaware of is a good idea, because then they'll give you some of the nuances that you wouldn't have known about. And then checking the labor and professional costs with your builder, especially around labor, you know, how much is it going to cost for him to replace the boiler? How much, let your builder know. And do your due diligence around the costs, and then evaluate the area and the valuations again. That is, again, coming back to speaking to the estate agents and then coming back to do your numbers around the rental and the sales valuations in that area once you have a better idea of the nuances, and then estimating the refurbishment or development costs overall. By the time you speak to your builder, you've checked the costs of, say, professional costs, you know, and cost of the architect, if you're going to do any type of internal reconfiguration or if you are going to get a structural engineer, surveyors, some of these different professional costs can also impact on your overall budget. So making sure you have it all sorted out, and then completing your deal analysis. And that's the last one on your due diligence, is that you've done your legals, you've done your financials, and then you just complete your deal analysis and you're ready to go to the auction. And then this is a good example of some of the documentation you would see typically in with a lot. You know, you see the title plan, you see the lease, the freehold deed, you see the lease plan. Sometimes you don't actually see the detailed lease plan, but sometimes you will. So it just depends. But definitely you see the rest. You see the register, service charges, the EPC, special conditions usually will be there. And then searches, which would be environmental, chancel, and then local searches, the local authority searches. So those are typical standard legal documentation that you come across. But then, like I said, if you're starting out, then you just have somebody kind of look over it and make sure everything is stacking up. And then the auction day. And pretty much on that day, a lot of auction houses would already, especially in post-COVID times, they're expecting that you send in all of your documentation online and that they've vetted you. So you send in your ID, you send it. But previously, you had to have that with you because it would actually impact on you being able to buy the property. So you've bid, you've won, but then if you don't have your proof of ID, you don't have your proof of address, then those types of things can cause problems at the auction. So it's important to take that along. And then checking the addendum again before bidding. So, you know, if it's an online bidding, then you check on the website, make sure you check the addendum. If it's a physical in-room bid auction, then you go in and then you check for the addendum board. And then, like I said, make sure you have your necessary documentation. And then also what's important to think about before you go in to buy is the structure in which you're buying. Are you going to buy in your name or are you going to buy in a company name? And, you know, you have time because up until the point where you have to write the name of who the buyer is on the contract, you pretty much have to determine what name is going to be on there. And interesting, I've actually created a company on the fly just because I realized we got the property and it was kind of a last minute, you know, opportunistic type of thing where I'd done the research. I knew it was a good deal. I didn't expect it to go for so cheap and it did. So, you know, right there and then we came up with the name of the company and then called the accountant to quickly set it up. So just having an idea of what the company structure is before you go in is important to save you from that sort of hassle. And then of course, immediately after you're successful, then you send the contract to your lawyer that day, if possible. If you can scan it, just scan it, just send it, and then the rest goes in the post. And then contact your broker to finish the financials. And that's pretty much the auction day. And then post-auction strategies, if you don't win, there's still a chance to review owned sold lots. And lots of people tend to find deals. I haven't actually found a deal in an unsold auction before. There was one deal actually, but in the end it didn't work out. So but it's a good source where lots of properties haven't sold, especially in those auctions, not maybe in today's day when all the properties are being sold at ridiculous prices. I mean, when we have lots of properties in the auction and you have like 300 properties in the auction and there's this chance where quite a number of them won't meet their reserve prices, then those properties, there's still a chance to pick up some good deals. And then if you were bidding and it didn't meet the reserve price and was withdrawn, like what I said, you can approach the auction to do a deal and they will just get the seller on the phone and that deal will be done. You can also reach out to the winner and congratulate them. So sometimes you'll know who the winner is. So you're watching them once they do their contract, if you're still in the auction, because it's a very good idea to network in the auction when you go. You know, I've met some really good, you know, sources in the auction room. And if you hang around, yeah, you lost, you are disappointed, but you hang around, some people will come and talk to you because of what happened and they're like, oh, you know, you could have paid more, you know, different people always have their own opinion. And then if you see the winner again, you can go to them. And it's always a good idea to actually ask them what they are, if you see that they are chatty, which for the most part, you know, I've spoken to quite a few, and what will happen is sometimes they'll be chatty and they'll be telling you, oh, this is what the property I was telling you about where it was my plan A versus my plan B, which is what I got. The plan A property, I went to the lady afterwards to say, oh, so what are you planning to do with the property? Because it seemed a bit high what you paid for it. And she said, well, yeah, I paid a bit more, but I want to keep it in the family. But actually, it wasn't very true, because it turns out 2 months later that she sold that property for about 200,000 more than she bought it at. So it was actually a really good deal in the end. It's just that she obviously had the big pockets for it, because it was completely outside of my own budget. But she, because such a good, the layout was so amazing.
Hello, the lock light's breaking. We can't hear you. The lock bar. We can't hear you. I mean, I can't hear you.
Yeah, I can't hear her either. Maybe we should just send her a message.
Lovely. I'm doing so now.
Yeah.
She's off. She's gone. Off.
Oh, she's gone.
She's probably going to dial in again.
KB.
Thank you for ringing.
Okay.
I'm sure she knows. Well, we can't hear you.
You're no Are you longer, serious? When did you stop?
I think she's asking when where she stopped. I think let me see.
It was the legal bid, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Legal section.
Okay. The legal section. So we're saying the legal section. We all can't see you.
Yeah.
Gosh. Sorry. I wonder what happened.
Yeah.
Because I saw your number coming in. I was like, what's going on? I've been talking.
No.
We sent you a message in the chat, in the group chat.
We sent you a message on the chat as well. But anyway.
My chat is completely disabled. I don't know what
happened.
So you guys are on the meeting?
Yes, we're all
Yes,
here.
We're in the meeting.
So bizarre, because I'm out of the meeting.
Yeah, oh.
Post-auction strategies. I think that's where.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Post-auction. Okay, cool.
Okay,
all right.
Lovely. All right, thanks. We'll be waiting for you.
Okay, cool.
Thanks. Right. Bye. Bye. Thank you. Hello, I've just spoken to Dolapo. She's still trying to log in. And she says that if she's not able to do so, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, she says if she's not able to do so, that she'll probably generate another link for us to...
Okay, to log on again.
Yes, but she'll let us know.
Okay, I'll just wait here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to have you back.
Hey.
We can't hear you.
I can hear you now.
So where did they cut out? Because I now have to try and recall where I was.
I think Bola said it was like at post, the
auction
post
strategy.
Yeah, post
auction strategy. Auction strategies. Yes.
All right.
Okay, so now when we come to post-auction strategies, so just because you didn't win doesn't mean that you can't actually still salvage it. In the most times you can't, but there are all the strategies to also check to see if there are other deals that can be had. So you can review unsold lots where you'll go through the list of properties that didn't sell at that auction, either because they didn't meet their reserve price or, you know, for whatever reason. And then you will make an offer to the auctioneer to say you're interested in that property. So you can review the lots, and a lot of times there are deals you can find within those properties. And if it didn't, if the property that you were bidding on didn't actually meet the reserve price and was withdrawn, you can approach the auction to do a deal directly. And what they'll do is that they'll get the seller on the phone and you will do a deal and meet somewhere halfway for the most part, because the seller has put it in the auction because primarily they want to sell. So there are all these different people that put their properties on the market. Sometimes you have institutional sellers who are the banks, the housing association, they want the property sold. And if it's a personal situation like a probate or where it was a repossession, they also want the property sold. So if it hasn't met the reserve price, they're happy to do a deal for the most part, because you're very close to whatever their reserve price is. And then you can also reach out to the winner. This is a strategy I was saying, where you can reach out to the winner and congratulate them. And if they are the type of person that will have a conversation, then find out what they plan to do with the strategy, with the property, because you might pick up a strategy from there, because different people approach properties differently. So reach out to the winner, congratulate them, and you'll find out that, you know, there are, you know, potentially you could either even just strike a relationship. And then also network with people in the room, you know, because I've met some really good people in the auction room, because you're all there for a united purpose. Also, being in the auction is this, it's almost like you have like this subset of people who are property investors, but also go that extra mile by buying from the auction. So it is a small network, and very soon you start to know people who are regulars at auction. So network around the room, even though you may not have gotten the property, you can still pick up good contacts and good deals from the auction. And then contact the auctioneer and give your details, because sometimes they will take your details, but it's good for you to also follow up after a few weeks to see if the deal is going through and everything's looking like it's going to go through. Because if the deal, if the purchase falls through by the contact who bought the property, who won the property, then there's a chance for you to also buy property afterwards. So it's just keeping that there are post auction strategies that you can also apply. Now, moving, so we've now gone through sourcing the property, all of the different steps that you would go through in sourcing in the auction up onto the point of bidding. Now you have the property, you've bought the property, and it's important that you're not only looking at the property in terms of its current value, but that you've estimated how you're going to force the appreciation. So there are two ways a property can increase in value, either by the passage of time, by you holding the property and waiting for time to pass and then the property appreciates, or where you use creative strategies to push that value up. And we're going to come to creative strategies that work well in the auction, of which I've already mentioned that the buy, refurbish, refinance model works very well with auction properties. And the fact that you're finding discounted properties in the auction as well helps that not only do you have sort of the uplift to get to the current value at the current dimensions and state of the property, is that in addition to whatever you then do to modify the property, then you now have an additional increased value that takes you to the new value. So there's a good differential between what you paid and what you are able to achieve if you've done your analysis properly. So it's all about creating that forced appreciation within the deal. And some of the strategies that we'll go over, of course, we mentioned the buy remortgage, the buy, refurbish, remortgage, and rent process. But then I have two of them, because there's the standard rental where you just rent it to a normal buy-to-let family, a single family occupier or single person occupier, and just earn your income that way. or there are more creative strategies that have emerged where you would either have it as a house of multiple occupancy where you're getting, or service accommodation where you're getting much more returns on your rental. So some strategies work so well in auction in that whoever you're bidding against might be actually buying that property as a normal tenanted property where they were just going to have a single assured total tenant in the property. Therefore, they're not happy to bid as much as you potentially would because you know you have more creative strategies up your sleeve. So in the days when service accommodation was not as popular as it was, as it is now, it was always a strategy that helped me to be able to outbid other people in the room, and which is why sometimes they would come to me and say, oh, you paid too much for that. But that's because I understood that by the time I finished remodeling the property, the amount of rent I would be getting from that property would more than compensate whatever extra amount I paid, especially for the right layout. So it's also knowing what strategy works with what layout. And then flipping. So flipping is a very popular strategy with auction. In fact, it's the way I got into buying in auction. Is my understanding of auctions was you buy the property, do the property up, and then put it back on the market to sell. And it's a strong strategy. There's some locations that it works very well in. It typically works well in an area where it's a high rate of owner occupiers that buy in that area, because those people are typically not going to come to the auction to buy. They're just looking for a nicely done up property. They probably have the financial resources to be able to buy a property off the market. And they're not trying to make a deal. They just want a nice property that they can live in without the hassle of refurb. So some owner occupiers want to go down the refurb route, but a lot of them don't. So finding an area like that where it's a high occupancy rate of people who own their properties, so that if you find that property in that location and you buy it at a discounted value, you up the through creative strategies, increase the number of rooms or remodel the property, then you know that by the time you're flipping the property onto an owner occupier, they are the type of buyers that you're looking for. And you normally will find them through estate agents, because they just go straight to the market to go and buy the property. So there you can get your good uplift if you're looking to use flipping as a strategy. And then title splitting. And this one has been quite successful in that we're able to get a property that was a whole house and then split it up into individual flats. So that's sometimes how you can do a title split. Or one that I've always looked for, but I haven't been successful at, is buying a building on an oversized plot. And what happens is you typically find a property in it tends not to be in central, or probably be a bit further out. But what you look out for are buildings that have that sort of extended plot. And they're usually at the end, they're usually the end terrace building where they have they have an access to get to the back as well. So what you can then do is you buy the property at a normal price. So for instance, you would even not mind paying a bit more because you know the strategy that you have in mind for it, where you're going to build, eventually you're going to build a property at the back. And typically if you do it well, that property will more or less pay for the property, or at least almost half the property that you've bought in the front end by the time you finish doing up the property on the lot. So that's a very well-known strategy as well, where you find a property on an oversized plot and you split the land so you can create another completely new building off of it. And then commercial to residential, very popular. And one of the reasons why it's popular is because it's like getting into land deals without necessarily having to start from scratch. So you get a nice commercial building, it already has all the brick and mortar, and you just reconfigure the internal. So these deals tend to be higher priced, and usually you might need investor financing to do it. But it's a good strategy to look at, especially if you go further outside of London where your funds can go further. Because as long as you pick the right council and you understand, obviously it's all subject to planning, and you understand that they've typically granted, in fact, yeah, with commercial to resi, it falls under the permitted development. So for the most part, you will get approved to be able to convert it. It's just that it will obviously have to just fit within the minimum room sizes and making sure it fits within their overall plan. But commercial to residential deals are very good, strong deals for creating value. The only thing to keep in mind is that usually they are longer term deals. So where I was talking about where within 6 months you can recycle out your cash, usually these deals tend to be longer, could be 18 months or, you know, or longer, but the rewards at the end are so much more significant. You know, sometimes these deals are rewarding at about like 250K, 300, 400, you know, really strong valuations at the back end of it, but it's just that it takes a bit longer. And then other deals are things like land deals, you know, where people will source land. They'll do the planning gain, you know, and I should put planning gain on here, where you, what you do is you find the land, you just go to, usually these lands will not have planning on them already. And then you apply to the council to get planning approved to build, you know, whatsoever, you know, whatever you think would appeal to an investor and a developer. And then you put those, you put that deal in the auction. Now, that is a strategy all by itself, so that you can buy the plot in cash or even with financing, you get the planning. Obviously, it takes a bit of time, but by the time you're done, you don't have to go through the hassle of actually doing the development. You can just put it in the auction or put it on the market to sell as a commercial deal. And then short leases, as I said, some people have a strategy around short leases where they will buy properties with short leases with cash, knowing fully well that they only need to negotiate with the freeholder for the balance of the payment of the lease. And then once they've gotten that approved, then they can go to a mortgage company and then get a full mortgage on the new extended lease. It's definitely a complicated process as well, but it's one that also has value. And as you start getting more into sort of these auction strategies, obviously you start with the simpler ones, but as you get into it, you start to find out more information about some of these more complex strategies that you could then go down. And some people just kind of focus on some of these complex strategies because they've now found a system that works for them. Maybe they have all the contacts and, you know, it just, it's just a simple process for them. So it's really about your own journey as well. And then regulated tenancies, as I mentioned, that's another strategy, because what happens is if you buy a property with regulated tenancy and it has a lower valuation because of the rental, once those people move out or they pass away or whatever it is that gets them out, then you can get the property valued at the right valuation with the correct updated rental value. So that's also a different strategy that some investors employ. And then, of course, some investors just love distressed properties that they can buy in cash. They can resolve whatever the distress is and they can put the property back on the market. Or legal issues. There's some that have something to do with maybe the title, right of passage, some neighbors or tenants downstairs, all these types of legal issues that I personally do not touch because I just don't know much about dealing with legal issues and the impact it could have on my bottom line. But there are some people that are very well versed with legal issues and they're happy to go down that route, but it's also quite a lucrative route as well because fewer people are bidding with you on those. The thing about these other strategies is that you have fewer people bidding with you, so you're able to get them much easier. And then we move to modifying the property, and this is where it gets interesting because we're now talking about the new layout, and this is where the money really is, because you've sourced the property, you already know what you are trying to do, and this is where you're physically doing it. So in a way, this modifies the property, even though it's here, it covers how you know the layout of the property, how you can identify the right layout for the strategy that you want to employ, but it also covers how you deal with the eventual refurb of the property, because that is one of the key factors in the entire process, because most properties that you buy in auction are going to need work done, either development or if it's just a simple refurb, but you're still going to have to interface with someone or a contractor or professionals along that process. So it's also about building your power team, which we'll cover in the next module. But what I wanted to explain to you is while you're looking at properties and you're going to shortlist properties, it's important that you understand the way the layout works to maximize. So this is a standard HMO situation. You're not trying to, this is not the type of HMO that's some complex HMO where you get an you know, an architect to remodel. This is one of those types of properties that you walk in and you can quickly identify, oh, this is a quick turnaround HMO. And if you can see the before picture, you can see it's the typical two bedroom upstairs and then a separate living room and a dining room downstairs, right? And what that helps you do is, as you can see with the new configuration, there's some things that are important to look out for. First of all, the fact that the bedroom size is quite a decent bedroom size. So you can insert, the living room is quite a big living room. So, you know, you can insert an ensuite bathroom here. And the dining room is separate. So right now you can see that there's a wall here. So actually, if you were to walk into this property, it's not actually separate. It looks like one big whole space, but you can see here the retention wall that has been broken to create that access. And what you're going to do is you're just going to put that wall back somewhere around here to create this room, right? And once you've created this room, what happens is you now have your separate bedroom downstairs from what you have as a living room, which then goes into the kitchen. So this is a very simple layout that works because you have the front living room. It's like a double, it's usually when you walk in, it's a double reception room where you have the dining room and the living room, and you can easily split it out so that the living room becomes your new bedroom or vice versa. And then upstairs as well, you have the layout where you have the bedroom and then you have another bedroom and then a bathroom at the back. And what has been constructed here is you now have the bedroom smaller because you want to create another bathroom. So with the HMO, as you understand, you need to have enough bathrooms to service the property. So you have one bathroom downstairs and you have another bathroom upstairs, and the two rooms are sharing this bathroom plus this third room. Now this third room is the one that you just need to be aware of in terms of the dimensions, because this dimension might just be slightly too small, but from what I can see, it's 3 by 2.2, 2.3, so it will be fine. So the reason why I'm showing you this is so you have an idea of how you can very quickly remodel a standard two-bedroom house into, two-bedroom house into a four-bedroom HMO, right? So that is a simple strategy. It won't cost you too much getting in as a simple way to configure a standard house into a HMO. And that's why I talk about the strategies and the type of properties, because if you came in and you found out that this bathroom was too small, then that can turn into a bedroom. Or if the kitchen was located, was very small, in which case it would be awkward to kind of, because right now what you can see is that there's an access created between the kitchen and the living room that makes it easy to be able to kind of flow between. That being said, there are some HMOs in which this living room would actually be a bedroom as well, which would be a 5-bed HMO and a kitchen, you know, where people would just go and cook or do whatever, but everybody would have their own living quarters. So it's all about how you want to design the property, making sure that you are keeping in line with the HMO regulations as well. If the property is over 3 families, then usually most councils will expect that you have a HMO license in place. So that's for the HMOs. And then if you wanted to remodel a standard simple flat, which I prefer flats because they're just the quick, simple type of strategies to get into, especially starting out. Now, why I say layouts with no potential is because, first of all, one of the biggest plays with this creative strategies we talk about is being able to remodel the kitchen and the living room into this open plan setup. Because if you can't do that, and this layout has no potential because the kitchen is already in the living room. It's already been, the advantage has already been taken out. You have this bedroom over here, right? And you have a bathroom over here and then the hallway. So there's not much you can do with this property. If you bought this, let's say this is a one bed flat. If you bought this property and you even got, unless you get a really, really discounted rate, there's really not much to do with it. So it's funny because in the last auction, there was a property that was slightly lower than the average price in the area. But when I did the math, I thought it doesn't make that much sense because there are other properties that have that added advantage. So if I had an investor, I would probably pass on that property to the investor because investors sometimes don't really care about, you know, well, when I say investor, I mean, depending on the investor, if the investor is say one of the sort of moderate investors, not trying to do too much, maybe has a full-time job, just wants to have a property portfolio on the side, then that sort of person would take that property because it's a discounted valuation, property, and they would still do well on the rent. But for me, because I know the value of the funds and I'm trying to maximize them, I would sooner pass on that property and wait an extra month for another property to come on the market that will suit the budget that I have and that I can do the uplift with. So this property as well, I mentioned because even though it has the wide living room, which is a criteria, it also has the same sort of kitchen already built in. So there's not much value in this property as well. Now, the properties that do have the value are those, this is a good example. It has a nice living area. So we're looking at 4x6x3.4, which is just about the minimum you want to be able to convert this into an open plan living dining. Because you can easily slip in your kitchen along this wall and then just arrange your living room around the bay window area. So ideally you want the rooms to be typically about 4x5, but this would, you know, and it's also about walking into the room as well. And that's why you go to for the viewing, because this would make the shortlist for me, because I would look at it that, well, let me walk into this living room and get the sense of how tight it feels. Because sometimes if the living room has high ceilings, then you can get away with it. If it has low ceilings, then it may not be suitable. Also, another play is to be able to take out. So I've done it before where the living room was small, but exactly this layout, I was able to cut this bedroom just a little bit so I could get a kitchen into that corner and then put a doorway in through here. So that you then have your living area, dining, and you have a little bit of a kitchenette here, and then you still have a bedroom, and then you can convert the kitchen into a bedroom. Because you can just strip out all of this. And this is a decent 3x3. And 3x3 is a nice size double bedroom. You can even get away with a 3x2 bedroom and still be able to remodel it in the way I'm talking about. And then you have the standard bedroom. So this property is currently a 3-bed. And then you could easily convert it to a 4-bed. In this case, actually, this property might not be 100% suitable because it's already too many bedrooms, but it would still add that additional value in that. The reason why I say that is because it would make sense for you to have yet another bathroom. Although I can see here that there is another bathroom. So you would have a 4-bed with one full bathroom and another shower room. So that would be fine. So you've already added the value in this property. So let's look at the criteria. Separate living reception room, separate large kitchens, not open plan, it's very important, and then wide living area so that you can slot in a kitchen into one of the rooms and into a section of the layout, and then generous room sizes, because sometimes what will happen is if one of the bedrooms isn't large enough, then you're still going to struggle a bit with renting out that property because everybody that walks in is just going to feel like all the rooms are too small. So looking for fairly decent sizes. So 3x3 is usually a good double size bedroom. This bedroom is a large bedroom anyway. And then check for windows. Like I said, it's very important. So if you look at, let's go back to this layout, the reason why they couldn't, because if you look at these two rooms, these two rooms could easily have just slotted in another small single room somewhere in here. The reason why they wouldn't do that is because there's no window against this wall. That means that room wouldn't be habitable, but you can put a bathroom in there because bathrooms and kitchens don't need to have windows within them. So that's a key tip, is that bathrooms and kitchens can slot into the middle of a property. And that's why this room here is the bathroom that used to previously be the bathroom has now been converted into a bedroom over here because of the window. So it's important that you, when you're looking at the layout, you're also looking at the window positioning for creating. Now, of course, all of this is just because you're doing the initial assessment and you don't want to hire an architect to help you remodel before you've bought the property. At the point where you've bought the property, then you can get an architect who will then help you properly remodel it. But in most cases, that's actually not necessary. If you've just looked at the dimensions, measured it up, and kind of just done a gut sense of how the room feels and the depth of the room and the size of the room, you should be able to maximize the value. And in the deal analysis, you'll see when we cover it next week, you'll see how amazing you can add value just from some of the simple techniques that I'm showing you that you do within these auction properties. Granted, you could do this with the property out on the market. You know, I'm not saying that specifically only to auction properties. It's just because within the auction, you've already bought it at a discounted price. Then you're reconfiguring the properties in this sort of simple way, and you're adding the value. And I'll show you some of the valuations on some of those deals because they are quite impressive and really don't cost that much. And then modifying. Part of modifying the property, as I said, is understanding and evaluating the work that's required. So originally you've already done a sort of behind the paper valuation of what you think the work should be done. Now, this is where the rubber meets the road, in that this is where the physical, you're going to be parting with cash. So you're now narrowing down the job scope and the specifications of the job down to, oh, this is the bathtub I'm going to get. This is what I'm going to get. This is maybe because you paid too much in the auction, you want to cut down on some of the excesses that you may have estimated for originally. So, you know, within this point, this is where you can really narrow down what you want to do within the property. And then you also shortlist your power team. You know, do you want a general contractor? So starting out, I usually would say go with a general contractor, a set price, so that you build a relationship with someone who's responsible for the project. Over time, like now, I can self-manage because I know some of the key elements that go into the project. So I can manage all the different contractors. But starting out, because if you're starting out, you don't really know about refurbs, then it might be, you know, so each of them has an advantage in that general contractors would generally be slightly more expensive because you're paying for that extra, you know, oversight, but it's worth it if you don't have much insight into what goes into developing a project, especially as you get larger. And I still maintain that. So if I'm doing a simple project, then I'll do it myself. But if I'm doing a larger project, like an extension, especially if it's a complicated extension, then I will always get either a structural engineer or an architect to be the project manager to protect against any downside risk. And I don't know if you picked up throughout, ultimately you're trying, the reason why you have all the plan Bs and all of that is to protect against any downside risk of losing your investment. And then also dealing with contractors. We'll cover best practices in the next module as well, because there are ways to deal, even if you are going to be self-managing and from the onset, there are ways to deal with contractors to protect against them trying to rip you off. And then sourcing the materials. You know, I always say with the first fix, then the contractors can provide that. I don't want to be providing anything that you can't see on the surface. So like all the wires, the plumbing, that the contractor can do, but that's a decision you have to make for yourself. I've decided it's not worth the time for me to be sourcing those materials, but I will still, at this point, still source my bathtub, sink, and all those things that are going to be the aesthetic presentation of the property, because I want to keep I want to know how it's going to look. I want to take responsibility for the end result. And when we come to presenting the property, which is the next point and the next step, you'll see why that's important. So it's assessing the quotations as well and the work schedule. And of course, the three key factors are based on time, and the quotations you get, they'll always give you a time estimate, which you can compare with other. I always say get at least 4 or 5 quotes just to get an idea and an assessment of what the general prices are. So it's going to be based on time, based on budget and scope. So they'll give you a budget based on the spec that you've given them and the scope that you've agreed. Now, be careful about scope and spec and budget, because sometimes builders can be very smart in giving you lower spec products at a certain price. And then when you then come to actually doing the works and having the refurbishment at that point where you need to actually get it done, then you realize the difference, and then they can always uplift the cost, because they'll say, oh, well, this is the spec for which we quoted against. Now you want to change the spec. So if, say, for instance, they quoted for 3 lights in the bedroom, and then you realize 3 lights is too little, you need 4, and the price is going to go up, because they're going to, you know, and they will usually add an additional price than, you know, it depends on the builder, obviously, but it's just keeping an eye on the spec as well. So we'll cover some of those as well in the best practices when you're dealing with contractors. And so when we talk about presenting the property, you know, again, presenting the property is down to the strategy. These pictures are mainly to do with service accommodation, where you're really presenting the higher end, especially the higher end type of service accommodation. So, but you need to be matching your properties to the strategies in terms of the way you present the property. So in this case, this is a standard HMO, right? So you see that the furniture is more on the lower end, and it does depend on the type of HMO you have. There's some HMOs that are super spec'd out the same way the service accommodation properties are spec'd out, just because they're trying to attract the higher end clientele. So that is down to your strategy. If you're going to go with the lower budget HMOs because of the location you're in, then there's some locations that there's no point over spec'ing, because the type of clients you're going to get will always be of a certain type, if they're builders, or if they're, not to say that builders don't want to live in the stunning flats, but clearly people who work in the city and are professionals will want a certain level that, you know, sometimes other people may not. And then the cost of setup is also making sure you're keeping in line with the area and the expectation of the area. So if you're in a luxury area, then obviously, you know, your cost of setup is going to be more expensive. And that's the cost of setting up and staging the property, the type of furniture and whatever you're going to put into the property. But if it's in a lower end type of property area, then, you know, you can do it up nicely, but you don't have to break the bank. You know, they always talk about the budget furniture versus the premium or the luxury furniture. So it's about you also assessing your strategy, your area, and your furnishing as well. And then it's key that you keep in mind that if you're doing a flipping strategy, that 7 times out of 10, you'll have to furnish it. Because sometimes people walk in, unless it's in a really highly sought after area, sometimes people will walk into a property and they can't imagine or visualize what the property is going to look like without furniture. And that can delay them making the choice of whether to go ahead or not. And I've had this happen in one flat in particular, where I just had so many viewings and no offers. And at some point I realized this because the bedroom looked small. But the minute I put in a double bed, which was a decent sized double bed, and put in 2 side tables, then all of a sudden anybody that walked in realized, oh, this is a decent sized bedroom, because it had all of that in. And then I started getting offers. So it's about sometimes thinking about some of the disadvantages, because all properties are made differently, right? So some properties will have strong features, and some will have features that you need to compensate for. And sometimes furnishing can hide the things that you're trying to keep away. And you're not hiding anything that, you know, is like untoward. It's just that properties are not always perfect, right? So you're trying to present it in its best light. And that's why this is called the presenting the property. You're trying to with the minimum amount of cost, trying to present it in its best light, especially if you're coming to rent it out to higher end professionals or you're coming to sell the property on. And then letting the property, clearly this is only targeted towards if you're going to rent the property out either as a long-term tenant or to a professional HMO. It's going through the right tenant to make sure that you've gone through the rigor, you've gone through their identity, gotten good references, checked how much they earn, and make sure you keep on top of their track record. And for the most part, if you can tick all of these different boxes, you have a good tenant. Unless a life circumstance happens, most times they will keep on with the rent. And I've been renting out for how many years? I barely have to do any credit checks. As long as the paperwork stacks up, for the most part, you have the right tenant. So it's keeping that in mind, because letting the property is also very important when it comes to the next step, which is the extracting the value, where you've done the deal, you've gone through this, you've refurbished the property, you've now let the property. And remember, it's all about the valuations from the deal. So when you're looking at the rental, you're looking at remortgaging to extract the dream, really, is to, as I said previously, is to extract 100% of the amount invested. That's your cash investment. Depending on what location, some locations in the Northeast, it's very, very easy to achieve them. In London, it's a bit harder to achieve it. But like I said, it depends on the cash left in. It might still make more sense than leaving it in the bank. And you also have the access to the fact that the property is appreciating anyway. And then your strategy will determine the duration of your project. So like I said, if you go back to the strategy slide where I talked about all the different strategies, simple BRR method, you know you're out in 4 to 7 months. The more complex refurbs, maybe you do a loft, you do an extension, you're looking at about 9 to 12%. 12-month turnaround period. And then when you come into the planning and the land development, then you're looking anywhere onwards of 18 months to 2-3 years. So it's all about the strategy that you look into. But for the most part, for people coming in, you're looking at the simple buy, refurbish, remortgage, and rent deals, or maybe the HMOs, or maybe the lofts, as you progress. And then you can go into title splits and those types of things where you find a whole building and divide it into three flats. That will still take, 9 months, 12 months, but still good return on your investment as well. So that's pretty much the property kept simple method, where you've gone through sourcing the property, you've increased the value, you've modified the property, you've presented the property for whatever strategy, and then you let it and extract the value. And this ties in very well with the auction process, because you're able to run through the entire auction process following this framework. And you just repeat the method pretty much to grow your portfolio. And it's the way I've pretty much run this business over the past 10 years. And I could have had bigger successes if I was more brave and I didn't protect so much against my downside risk, because I'm so risk averse, as much as I may not appear to be, but I am quite risk averse in that the deal needs to really stack up. I need to have crossed all the T's and I's before I get into it, because I'm really trying to protect my investment. I feel like we have limited resources, so the limited resources must work hard for us, but they must also be protected. So I've definitely passed on deals that would have ended up being so much better if I had more bravery, but I'm quite happy with my progress, and I've just kept it simple. And it's why the overall business name is also Property Kept Simple, because I feel like there are ways to make money within property without necessarily taking the risky deals. But you can, but it's all about your own personal choices. So that I'm just putting in my own two cents, which is very much my own personal choice. And so the next module, which we've done a good 2 hours now, is really about area and deal analysis. So we'll be doing a bit more of the number crunching, how you will then pick a deal, do the valuation, check out all of the different pricing around it to make sure that it works. And if it doesn't, you just pass it on and move on to the next. And then you have the refurbishment best practices, like I said, how you pick the right contractors, how you qualify them to make sure that they will be in your power team and will work well for you. And then understanding the funding sources. So funding sources are very important. I've already mentioned lightly on private funding. You have angel investors. You have, you know, the more accessible funding is bridging. It's the easiest funding to get for most of your projects. It's the most expensive sometimes. And also, depending on which bridging company you go with, there can be some clauses you need to look out for, but we're going to cover all of those as well. And then some of the fees, and then how to do your area research as well to make sure that, you know, like I covered it lightly, like some of the estate agent calls you have to make, and so we'll go a bit deeper into the area research. And then of course, building and qualifying your power team. And that's not just your contractors and the workmen that are gonna do work for you. It's also the accountants, the professional services that are gonna feed into your business. And then of course, the final one is reviewing all the different templates. So you have templates around the deal analysis, you have templates around the checklists to view a property, and then all the checklists around how to prepare yourself to go for the auction. So that's what we'll be covering in the next module. So if you have any questions and answers, if you can unmute yourselves.
I have questions.
Yes.
Quite a number of them. So I would give other people room as well. So it's not to monopolize, but some of them are very simple. So when I've looked at an auction before where they've said rooms and they say 5 rooms, does that mean that that's the living room, the bedroom and the kitchen, or how do you determine what
that room constitutes? So 5 rooms, like I said, it also includes the living room. So when you see, especially on that first page, they're usually talking about the number of bedrooms in the property. But then just like I showed you the number, the 2 rooms downstairs, in the house, the living room and the dining room counted as part of the room. So it's actually a 3-bedroom house.
Okay. So yeah, the living room and the bathroom is there, but not the kitchen.
So the bathroom and the kitchen are excluded from the rooms. Okay. Every room that's either living space is called a room, like you saw. So sometimes it's easier with flats because you know it's just the living room. But in this case where you have like 2 reception rooms, that's also counting. So you might have normally thought it was a 4-bedroom, but actually it's a 3-bedroom house with 2 living rooms downstairs or 2 reception rooms downstairs.
Okay.
But it's a good HMO. It's a good HMO strategy because you can use the front room as a bedroom, and the 3 bedrooms upstairs, and that's even if you didn't do any work. So,
I have another question, but I'll after this, the other people can ask. I still have more. I'll pause. So you know, like on the morning of the auction, sometimes like you have all these notifications coming in saying there've been changes. If you're a newbie to this and you're having all those notifications and you've already had your document already reviewed by, you know, by the lawyer and everything, it can show you. I mean, because I felt like if there was a property I was going to bid on and there was a notification on that property on the morning of the auction, it would show me. So why do you do that, and how do you sort of go around that somehow to make sure you don't then, you know, you don't fall into a trap that they wait to the last minute to slot it in and then they catch you unawares or something like that?
Yes, and that's a good point. And I feel like that is probably more to do with these COVID times, as opposed to, because typically in the addendum, like when you go into the room, then they can't do these last minute changes like that, right? And even if they did, it would be listed on the addendum, so you would see, and you'd be, and because it's specific, it's not like it's hidden within any documentation. It's addendum is very clear. It's lots 5, and they'll tell you what changes have been made. So you know, it's not hidden within any document. But I know exactly what you mean because in the last auction I was looking at, I was just getting these notifications like about 10 minutes before the actual bid.
Exactly.
And I was like, why are they updating? What are they updating? But I think that what's happening is that these auctioneers have just transitioned to moving their platform online. And maybe this is about the second or third time they're doing auctions in this new format. And I know for a fact that this last auction, they struggled because they had to actually shut down the auction for it, which I've never experienced. Mm. They had to shut down the auction for an hour to go and resolve whatever it was, because some people that were trying to bid could not log on. And I had to come on and say, well, we have to pause. So then they were midway. They were just about to do the hammer on the property that I was trying to bid on.
Oh, you were bidding on that one.
It was the first one, yeah. And I just came off. But they so outbid that property. And that's why I was saying that this is probably not the best time. Although this new auction that's coming up, there are 250 something properties in there. So the market is getting better, and therefore the deals will start getting better. But you can imagine where there are only 80 properties in the auction, and then 3,000 people. And the only way is up. Right, so this is not usual times, and I feel like the auctions have really benefited from this lockdown. It's really, really suited them. However, on the paperwork side, it's affected them not being able to keep up with, you know, technology and all of. So I suspect that this, what you're saying, is down more to technology than actually the legal pack just being submitted. I suspect that the auctioneer company themselves were trying to update some of these packages that had come in, maybe, you know, before, but they hadn't been able to keep up. So that's my own theory on that.
So you would go ahead and bid in spite of that, because this is something that you've had a lawyer review, and you can't just call them and say, oh, can you quickly look at this again? I don't know what they've amended or whatever, you know?
No, I think that you should be, because the thing is that the amendments cannot be, you know, and the amendments are going to be on the special conditions of sale anyway. It's not going to be in the main document. So you can quickly review what it was that your lawyer looked at and then try and see what the difference, because that's what I did. And I didn't even actually notice what the difference was. I thought they were just resubmitting the same document, because I couldn't see this subtle difference between the two documents. So I was still going to go ahead. In fact, I still went ahead and bid. Do you understand? It's just that obviously somebody was way more eager to get that property.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, because to give you some interesting fact, that property was on a road that I bought in last year, around August, September. And I bought it for 40,000 less. Do you understand? And that property is much larger dimension than this one. So I was just confused about why they were spending 40,000. As in, I did the math, and I was like, yeah, there is some margin in there to still make some money, but it's so tight by the time you think of bridging and you think of all this. But
so honestly, it went like 150,000 above the if this is what you're getting from an auction, maybe I should just look at an open market.
Yes, that's exactly what I thought. But guess what? I went to the open market, and it's equally as difficult. So because I was looking around, I met a few estate agents, and I was like, look, let me try and start building this relationship with these estate agents that I was thinking of, because I typically source my properties, because I just love the auction process. I've always found things there, and I always just follow the money, and I usually will find something. So for me, going to go and create all these relationships with all these random estate agents that can move easily at any point in time, for me just seemed like, but now I've started to say, well, I'm going to have to couple this with my auction strategy because of what's been going in the auctions. And for sure, those auction companies are not going to stop this online bidding because they've seen the value of it. Now, what one of them was saying was that, oh, they're not going to go back to the rooms. And I'm telling you that in another year or so, they're going to rethink that, because a lot of the auction process is also the networks that you make in the rooms. So you then saying that, oh, you're not going to be in the rooms because it costs so much, means that at some point, the ones that do go back are just going to, you know, because it means that they're going to have people bidding online as well as people networking in the rooms, right? Which means that there will just be a lot more buzz around auction. So let's see how it goes with buying in auction. It's still my preferred route. I feel like we need more properties to flood the market a bit more, and that as things start getting slightly worse with all of these layoffs and all the things going on, which we're only beginning to see, that
thinking about that you know, this whole follow scheme thing, that it's going to lead to a situation where we have more properties on the market, and you know. That would drive down prices. What you might think you're getting on the auction as a bargain, when there are lots of prices, when the following scheme ends, might not end up looking like a bargain after all.
That's if you buy it now. So I always say that the auction precedes the market, right? And, you know, I'm happy to challenge that statement, because what happens is that these professional investors are in the auction, right? And they're already quite resilient against market information. Mm. Now, when they're bidding, if you go into the auction, and I noticed this like over the years, that when people stop buying in the auction, it's because there's a fear that's beginning to sort of, because these are the same people that are going to sell in the open market anyway. Mm. So there's already a fear that's kind of feeding into the market, that they're already being conservative about buying in the auction. So the prices, you just have seen that even more properties will come on the auction, because it's way easier to sell in the auction than it is to sell in the open market when the market goes down. So there'll be lots of properties in the open market, but there'll even be more properties in the auction, mm-hmm. at least from my last experience, because they just need to get rid of these properties. So imagine a landlord who has had 3 months where tenants are not paying, and it's finally gotten them out. Mm. Is it going to have tickets in long-term markets where somebody's going to take 3 months before they complete? Or is it going to throw it in the auction market and hope to get something within a month?
So you think there are going to be a lot more property, like when the follow scheme ends now?
I think so. I think there's going to be a lot more properties come to the market, for sure.
Thank you.
So, but that's just my own, you know, at the end of the day, we're not crystal ball readers. We just have to follow the indication. So, but I feel like there will be
more. I have more questions, but I'm going to let others ask you.
All right.
Hi.
Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, just a quick question regarding the remodeling or the remodifying. Do you require a planning permission to do those sort of work?
So some of them you do. So if you're just including a loft in the property, then it falls under permitted development. So you just have to let the council know, and then they will do like a community request to say, does anybody object? Most times they won't object, because you know most people would have done it on the road. So that's I'm trying to remember, it takes about maybe 6 to 8 weeks for that to go through.
Okay.
But right, some other ones like extensions, you do need planning for that.
Okay. Well, like for instance, the one you did in, I think, New Zealand, the one converted from one bed to three bed.
So the one bed to three bed, I did need planning, but remember that I bought it with planning.
Oh, you bought it? Oh, okay. Yeah, because I wanted to ask how that was sort of eat into the time that
That's why it was an attractive deal for me, to be honest, is because it already came with planning. I'm usually looking at starting the auctions for things like that, because I've even seen one in this one where they already have planning. So it makes it much more attractive deal. But guess what? They have made money from the fact that they've uplifted it with the planning gain.
Yeah.
Right? So with the property that I bought, this example that I was telling you about, the one bed to three bed, I got it at 300, but the guy who did the planning gain bought it at 240 is what I discovered from the agent.
Oh,
yeah. Because the agent came to open the door for us to view it. So he said, the guy bought it for 240. He maybe spent $2,000 to do the planning. He didn't do anything. And then 3 months later, he sold in the auction and sold it for 60K more.
Mm.
Right?
Oh, okay.
So you understand. And then I went through my own process, and then I added another 150 or almost 200 to the price, right? Because I was moving from one to three bedrooms. But it cost a lot as well. So some people don't want to spend all that much money, but they've, you know, in fact, there's some people that just buy a property in one auction and then they put in another auction, and then they make 20K and they're happy with that, you know. They didn't have to spend too much. So yeah. So
how were you able to turn a one bed to a three bed?
Like with the
outside or like.
So, and this is what I say about being, when you're looking at properties, always looking with this sort of extra creative lens. So what happened was that property was actually listed as when you read the documentation, it said planning obtained for an additional room. So for the living room and the kitchen at the back. So you could turn it from a one bed to a two bed. But when I looked at and this is why I said you really have to get very conversant with layouts. When I looked at the layouts, because my game has always been to convert the kitchen into a bedroom, when I looked at the layout, I saw that the living room and the dining and the kitchen were so big. So I sent it to an architect friend of mine, and I said, look, can you see the back where they're extending the whole extension to create this massive living room, open plan kitchen? If I cut this part and just put in a bedroom there, would it work? And she said, yeah, the dimension is 8 by 5 or something. Meaning that even after we cut it, we still had 6. Do you understand? Look at those rooms I sent you. They were 3 by 4, 4 by 5. This one, after I've removed a whole room out of it, I still had 6 by 5, which was now the living and the open plan kitchen. So I was able to get a 2 by 3, something like a 2 by 3 bedroom, which is a decent sized single bedroom, and which helped me to then create. So that's why when I went to the auction, I was happy to pay up to, I think I was happy to pay up to about 320, 330, because I knew I could instantly convert to a 3 bedroom. But whoever was bidding with me probably was only looking at it as a 2 bedroom because that's what the planning said. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, okay. I didn't have to modify it or anything like that.
Okay, so if the planning says 2 bed and you add an extra room, is it allowed?
It's because of, so planning can't, this is what I'm trying to make the difference between internal reconfigurations and external. So if I was going to, I'm trying to think of what could be an amendment. If I was going to build an extra wall, no, even building an internal wall will not qualify. If maybe, I'm trying to think of what, but nothing's coming to mind. But right now, because all I was doing was just inserting an internal wall to separate out where the kitchen was going to be to convert it to a bedroom, that's not a planning, that has nothing to do with planning. Planning doesn't care about that. Planning doesn't care that you put internal walls in a building.
Okay.
Yeah. So, or planning also doesn't care if you also cut down walls in a, like, as long as it's internal to the fabric of the building, they don't care. When you start touching the external walls, so this is a good example. So if, say, for instance, I was going to build in a window into one of those walls, then yes, I would have had to go back to planning because that's touching the structure of the building.
Okay.
Dolapo, I just wanted to ask you, with what's going on now, do you think that now is a good time for us to buy? Like, obviously, if we're, for those looking to get into the market or...
So I'm still looking, but you see, it's all about the deal. And this is what I was explaining about the valuations and the deals and the rental. Yeah. So if you find a property today, right, that work in that you bought it, let's say it was 200, you added value, it was 350. Your rental allowed you to extract it at where your mortgage and your rental, there was a good difference between it, where your mortgage is, I'm giving a realistic example, where if your mortgage is around £600, but your rental is about 1,200, then, you're fine, because guess what? You've taken out most of your money from the deal anyway, from the remortgage. And the rest of the money that's in the property is well balanced with the rental that you're getting on the property. So you can still do that deal even in today's market. I say you can do it in a bad market as well. So it's just, obviously there'll be more deals later on. By the way, we're not crystal ball readers. We don't know that there won't be some, like maybe the market will pick up and then all the deals will then not go down as much as we thought. So if you if you find a good deal today, still take it.
Okay. Because,
you're not a crystal ball reader. You don't know that the prices are really going to tank like that. So I'm still looking. I'm still, evaluating.
Okay. Sorry, another question that I've got, something that has always intrigued me. You know, when you buy from auction and then you refurb and then you sell it, what are the tax implications? What do you have to pay?
Yes. So for flipping, it's very important, again, that you do it in a company structure, right?
Okay.
Because you're only paying the 20%,
Okay.
So, that's called trading. And when you're trading property, then it's just a standard 20% at the back end of whenever you sold. So you have to estimate that as well.
I think, Dolapo, isn't it that you can sort of roll over that into another property?
Not if you sell it. So this is why the remortgage process.
Because I was thinking, if you sell it, but you're going to be using the money to buy another property, maybe a bigger property.
So you make a point. Because you bought it in the company construct, as long as you buy that other property within the same financial year, right? Then you have to speak to an accountant.
I'm an accountant too. So.
Okay, good.
I'm a property accountant, but I know I did it in tax, where you can sort of, all over relief that you get, so that instead of paying taxes on the property, you invest it into another property.
Okay.
You don't have to pay tax until, it's like deferred tax, until you now sell that other property. And if you don't, and you liquidate it. But if you want to reverse, if you want to continue the process, you keep continuing it anyway.
Unless
they
did advise me that I had to be within the financial year, because
that's the one I need to read up. I can't remember, but I know
that's exactly. Because what happens if you cross a financial year and you haven't spent that money, then they're going to deem it as
come profit. Back.
Yeah, there must be like a
then tax, you pay the tax on it, then you cannot roll it. But if you do it within the financial year, then you can do what you're describing. But like you said, it's deferred taxation, because when you now sell the properties at the end, then whatever the new value minus all of that, right? So,
oh gosh,
yeah,
but I want to ask you a question tied to that. How easy, because I was talking to my broker and I thought about like setting up a company and asking these mortgage lenders to borrow money, and they were saying that, you know, it's like difficult for them to lend company, especially new companies, money and stuff like that. People like us that are starting out and want to just start a new company, we don't have a track record, we don't like to have anything. How easy is it to get, you know, someone to finance our deals?
Okay, so that's a very simple one, because I got caught out with that too, because I got into property almost in the same way you are getting into bad in like a bad financial market, and you have to buy it in your name. That's just the truth. You understand? When like, so if you have a portfolio already, then you can then set up a new company, and then at least you can show track record. But if it's the first property, then you have to buy the first one in your name. Because it's much easier to get the mortgage if you buy it in your name, because you will just, whether you're going to use a buy-to-let or whatever, they're just going to assume that it's a residential property and you're going to get more. And even if you wanted to buy a buy-to-let, it'd still be easier to get it in your name. The company structure, definitely they will require a track record. It's more difficult because there are fewer lenders in the market.
But then the tax advantage is gone from this buying in your name thing.
Not if it's the first property.
Yeah, but that would be a residential property, isn't it?
Exactly.
And then, but if you're doing a buy-to-let and you're not buying it outside of a company, and you and your IRA taxpayer, then you will be liable to more tax. You want to buy it in a company, but you don't have a track record except for the fact that you have a house that you're living in that is your home.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean?
So in this case, that means you're renting one property, or do you have a property?
So like, let's say I own my property.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. And then I want to become a buy-to-let landlord, but I want to buy my first investment property in a company. That's what I'm saying. That would I find a lender to give me money for that?
It's not that you won't find lenders. There will be lenders that will give you, because you already own your own property. I thought you were describing where you didn't own your property.
Yeah, owning your own property.
It'd be more difficult because of the track record situation. But you already own a property, so you can. So, but remember that they're looking at the deal in itself. It's a good deal. And, you know, they're evaluating the deal based on the rental valuation, based on all of that. Banks are definitely a bit more cautious now, but they are lenders in the market. They're definitely lenders in the market.
It will not be like the traditional banks then.
Probably not be the traditional banks for sure. But brokers have access to those types of lenders.
Also, and to that question, I think also you need to look at the, what do you call it? If you want to, let's say, buy in your name, or you buy it through a company, you should also remember that a company, you pay a bit higher interest rate than the normal one. So you need to work out, because like, for instance, mine, when I started, I got 8 properties, then the next one I move on to a limited company, and my accountant started porting some of the my personal ones into my company name. However, I have a threshold to say, okay, this is what I've got, it's been tax efficient owning this portfolio, and the next property have to go through that. So you need to work out.
Yes, the accountant will work with you.
Yeah, you need to work out. So sometimes it'll be better to own it in your, because some of my rates, I'm paying 1 point something. With the company one, I'm paying like 2 points to 3 points.
Yeah.
So you need to work out and see, because sometimes it might be a bit cheaper.
But in today's market, is there ever a situation in which just because the interest rate was lower? Because the way I look at it is, if you're now going to be paying higher tax
in the long run,
because you had it in your name,
like 40%.
Exactly, it will affect it.
Okay. Also, yeah, it depends on the strategy. Maybe you just want it for a short term. For short term, it would be better to do it through your company. Yeah. But for let's say long term, and I think what they were doing before was approaching the HMRC to say this person is buying off this. Before you wouldn't pay this stamp duty because you're porting, but now they've changed it. Because the ones in my personal name being ported into my company,
you have to pay stamp duty. Imagine.
Yeah, you have to pay stamp duty. But I think before what he did was, I don't know what he did, but he wrote to HMRC explaining something, and they were allowing.
Is this your sole income, or do you have another source of income?
No, I work. I work full time.
I'm surprised, because I heard that if it was your sole even though you work or you have another business, but it's all property related, then they can apply to HMRC to say it's your main source of income and it's your business. And so even though it's in your personal name, it won't require stamp duty to convert it.
He did one, but the other one, he couldn't do it. So that one is still stuck in my name.
The same problem as well, but I just left them in my name because I can't stop paying stamp duty and all of them.
Still. No. Yeah. Oh, gosh, all this tax. Sorry, I've just got another question, obviously, based on what we've been discussing. So I've got some properties, and obviously I've never bought from auctions like I discussed with you. So what I want to do is I want to buy and maybe turn them into HMO and keep them for long-term investment. So my thing is, I know that you're not an accountant, but it'd be nice for us to discuss this. My thing is, is it better for me to buy in my name or in the company's name? Because I'm not doing it for short term. I'm going to be doing it for longer term.
I have to go with the company again. Because
you have to go with the company, okay.
HMO, and that's a high rental strategy. With the fact that they're really we're now transitioning into the fourth year of this 2024, where now we'll be at 0% of mortgage relief interest payment now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has to be in a company name.
In a company's name, okay.
Well, actually an accountant, but just because you are even doing rental strategy with HMO. It means you're just going to be like I can't even imagine what income you'll be earning by the time you have a few HMOs. And remember, you're not going to be offsetting it against the
No, that's true. That's true.
On the high end.
That's true. That's
much.
True.
It's going to be too much.
Okay.
I'm an accountant, so you can.
What did you say?
I said you're an accountant, so you can confirm or. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
I have lots more questions, but it's 21:45 already. Don't worry, I can keep you on.
Maybe for next week.
So that's what I'm saying, that she will be seeing me for next week. Maybe I can voice it another time.
Can send me a message as well.
Okay. All right.
Hi. Okay. Cool. Are we going to get the video? Because I missed the first part.
I will send it. I don't know
if it's going
to come out now with all of the with the break in the middle. Sorry about that. I don't even know what happened, but
we'll send it. As a referral,
I'll send it out once this is finished. Download.
Okay. I mean the first part. So
you did. Yeah. I said I'll send you. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, okay, I have one more question, but should I let you go? Should I ask you another time?
I just ask quickly and then.
So, like, if you like have done like your shortlist and you have three properties that you think you might be able to buy, you want to bid on the auction, maybe one of them you hope you'll be successful with,